You're listening to Go with Jamarlin Martin. We have a go hard or go home approach as we talk to the leading tech leaders, politicians, and influencers. Let's go. Today we have Angela Benton, the founder and CEO of New Me. Let's dive right in, Angela. How's it going?
It's going great.
So, you know, we go way back.
Way back.
You're the pioneer and founder of Black Web 2.0. For the folks out there who weren't really around, I know, you know, we have new concepts such as Afrotech. We have, you know, different things going on. Angela started Black Web 2.0. I believe she was before her time, almost 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about, you know, starting Black Web 2.0? And do you feel like you get enough credit in terms of you've been in this space for a while, fighting for our people, being an advocate? Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So I started Black Web 2.0 in 2007, and it was, you know, basically a platform for African Americans in technology. And we covered the gamut from, you know, what Black executives were doing in tech to what entrepreneurs were doing. And, you know, it was a fun time, but it was the very, very, very early days. So I feel like it was like a group of us that all knew each other. You know what I mean? Just from, you know, being online and everything. And now, you know, flash forward, you know, 11 years later, and there's this much bigger community, you know, around it. And so it's exciting to see. And in fact, when I go to things like Afrotech or, you know, other events and people don't know who I am, I actually am like, wow, that's great. I mean, I think a lot of people may feel like slighted or something, but I think, you know, your true influence comes from if you are able to influence other people who influence other people. You know what I mean? Like your influence is huge at that point. So yeah, it doesn't bother me as much at all.
When you were, I like using religious terms, but when you were preaching Black tech religion way back in 2007, who else was doing that online? Because I don't remember anybody else kind of out there.
Yeah, I don't think there was anyone else. Now, well, there were actually, there was no platform. So there were individual people like Lindy Johnson, Omar Wasow, who is one of the founders of Black Planet. You know, so there were people who were involved in Black tech, but they weren't necessarily, like, there was no platform where everyone was like kind of congregating and people were talking about Black people and how we relate to technology, like in an intelligent fashion. So there wasn't anything.
Okay, got it. So you were prominent in a CNN special.
Mm-hmm.
What was the title of that special?
So that was Black in America, which was Soledad O'Brien's documentary series that she did for CNN. And the episode that we were in was The Promised Land, Silicon Valley. And, you know, this was around the time accelerators and incubators were just becoming popular around that time. And there was a lot of money flowing in Silicon Valley, really, at that time for people who just had ideas.
It was just bubbled up.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah. So how did that, how did you get on this program? Did they just reach out? They saw you in Black Web 2.0? How did that come about?
Okay, so Black Web 2.0 was like 2007. New Me was 2011. I had actually just transitioned from Black Web 2.0. Like I had let my last writer go. I was moving on to something else. And I actually didn't know what that something else was going to be until about a month later. And I was reminded that I had did a conference the previous year in 2010, the New Me conference. And this conference, I mean, it was small. It was like a summit. We handpicked like 100 entrepreneurs from like around the country. And the whole idea was to have kind of like a think tank on how we can get more Black entrepreneurs successful in the technology industry. And one of the, actually Don Charlton, who was the founder of a company called The Resumator, or formerly The Resumator, it's now called Jazz. he was working on a different company, I think, at that time. Possibly. Actually, no. I think it was the same company, the Resumator. But anyway, his feedback was, why don't we, they have these things called accelerators and incubators. Why don't we do one of those? And I remember thinking when he said it and got up and said it, that, wow, that's a great idea. But that seems like really hard to do, like a lot of work. And I didn't think about it again until March of 2011, when I started the planning process of getting New Me together. And so really, it was just a lot of legwork. I didn't know anybody in Silicon Valley, like running Black Web 2.0. I definitely had connections with people in the technology industry, like between New York, between Silicon Valley, but my connections weren't on the investment side at all. It was all corporate and stuff like that, from basically selling advertising and sponsorship at Black Web 2.0. So when I started reaching out to people and pitching this concept, we ended up getting like a ton of really good feedback from people and people wanting to support and sponsor, which was awesome. And so we were able to raise money to host, you know, 8 entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley for, at the time, it was 9 weeks. And throughout that whole process, we got a few articles written about us. One of them was, we had an article written about us in the Wall Street Journal Venture Wire, which is a trade journal. A producer from CNN had read that article and then reached out to us. So, you know, at the time, we had a lot of publicity and media and exposure. And people would always say, like, who is your publicist? Like, how did you make all of this happen? And it's like, you know, when you create a lane for yourself and you are authentic to who you are, like, stuff happens. Stuff falls into place that's supposed to happen, because I didn't have a publicist or anything. It just happened the way that it was supposed to.
And I see you on television. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there where they're covering the good work you're doing. Do you use a PR firm now?
Yeah, I have a publicist now. Okay. I've had a publicist for, I would probably say, the past 5 years.
So folks out there who are looking to build their brand and essentially have opportunities come to them organically, like yourself, mm-hmm. You know, what is the best advice for folks out there? Like, hey, I really want to build my brand and I want to put these pieces together to help my business.
I think a lot of people, when they start to talk about building a brand, especially online and in this age of social media, they tend to only think about like the aesthetic, right? So what does this Instagram post look like? Or, you know, what does my logo look like? And branding is actually so much more than that. I feel like, you know, I'm obviously very conscious of stuff like that, but I'm also very conscious about the people that I work with and that I partner with too. Like, I don't, there's a lot of people that just think the more activity they do, like, the further they'll get, the more successful they'll get. But I turn a lot of stuff away. You know what I mean? So I think you also have to be mindful about who you want to work with, how you want to work with them, and how that partnership will move your own brand forward.
Okay, got it. So you moved to SV from where?
I was in Charlotte.
Okay, and did you grow up there?
I didn't.
Okay, what's good? Like, how did you get to Charlotte?
So I grew up in the Northern Virginia area, and I was living in Maryland before moving to Charlotte. And at the time, you know, I was married, had kids, and, you know, we bought a house in Charlotte. Everyone was moving to Atlanta. So the plan, we actually had driven down. The plan was to buy a house in Atlanta, but we stopped in Charlotte because a lot of people were talking about Charlotte at the time. And we settled on Charlotte because it wasn't as saturated as Atlanta.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, just kind of weird just ending up in Charlotte, like, you know, with no family there or anything like that. And then, you know, when we had gotten, I guess, the go from the producers at CNN that we would be filmed, and everything, that was interesting. I knew that I was going to have to make a decision on where I was going to live, like, full time, because at that time I was divorced. by then. And, you know, so I was a single mom with three kids and like had my own business. And I knew that the documentary was going to be huge because nobody was talking about it. And I just feel like because, you know, I've been kind of in this space for so long since 2007, you can see and you can feel when stuff is starting to bubble up and stuff is starting to change. And I felt like that was happening at that time. And so many more people were even just interested in tech and interested in being involved or interested in how, you know, African-Americans could be involved. And so I think the timing was absolutely perfect for that. But I also knew, you know, when this airs, how many opportunities are you going to be able to catch and move forward on being based out of Charlotte? And not many. You know, you can't kind of be bi-coastal with three kids as a single mom. That's pretty hard to do. So, you know, I made the decision to relocate my family to the Bay Area.
And that special, I'm assuming it opened up a lot of doors for you in terms of making that bet that I'm going to go live in SV, and stuff kind of sprouted from your prior work. But the CNN, did it really give you like a push out there in terms of opportunities opening up?
How can I put this? So yes and no. When you have that level of exposure, you get different types of people that are attracted to you. So you get people that want to work with you and help with you genuinely. You get people who are just excited about what you're doing and they want to be involved and they really want to be like led. You get people who want to attach themselves and exploit what you're doing. And so, you know, there were a lot of doors that were, you know, open for me. Like, you know, my whole investor network, the base of it was Mitch Kapoor's investor network. You know, when we did the documentary series, he was an interview subject in it, and then really became like a mentor for our entrepreneurs, but then also for me, and like kind of guided us at the very, very early stages. And when it came time to do our demo day, him and Frida were involved. Frida Kapoor is his wife. Were involved, you know, in the planning process of that. We had it at their office, and he genuinely wanted it to be successful. He opened up his investor network. He sent emails out. I sent emails out. He sent follow-up emails to make, you know, people come. Yeah. So you get people like that, that, you know, are genuine.
Can you share a little bit for the audience on who the Kapoors are?
Oh, so
just really quick.
Yeah. So Mitch and Frida Kapoor, for people who don't know, Mitch is a legend. He started Lotus, which was kind of like a competitor to Microsoft products like Microsoft Word. They had like Lotus Notes, I think Lotus 1-2-3. Oh my God, I'm dating myself right now. Seriously. But so, you know, he is for sure a billionaire and then some. And he is the equivalent to a Steve Jobs. Like, that's who he hung out with. If you read the Steve Jobs biography, Mitch's name is mentioned in it because, you know, Mitch, Bill Gates, they were like in the same group of entrepreneurs that were working on things back in the day. So he is an angel investor now. They do some amazing work.
And what's their racial background for the audience?
Mitch is, he's white. He's Jewish. Yeah. Yeah. Frida, I don't know if Frida's Jewish, but they're white. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I hear a lot of great things about, from people who've actually worked with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we talked years ago and you talked about some of the bubbleheads in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really have conviction. They're looking for, a lot of these companies looking for PR. They don't.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the challenges you had within the SV culture living out there, and then that playing a part in you moving here to Miami?
Sure. So the culture in Silicon Valley is interesting because you have this perception of innovation, right? And so with innovation, you think people are generally open-minded, but it's a small percentage, in my opinion, there's a small percentage of people that are actually open-minded, who are actually the thought leaders, and everybody else just says everything that they say. And so when you have ecosystems that are like that, there's actually not a lot of original thought. And so, you know, if one person says, oh, I'm not working with this company anymore, all of a sudden, you know, this one company has a bad rap with like everybody in Silicon Valley. So there's things about the ecosystem like that that I didn't like. I mean, I like to think of myself as like an independent thinker. I just like to do things like creatively. And I kind of just try to operate in my own lane. However, especially starting like the first accelerator for minorities, a lot of people, of course, got it and they supported us. But there were still people who were like, so I just don't understand why this is needed, because there's Y Combinator or 500 startups. You know what I mean? And it's really hard to articulate to someone who doesn't understand, who thinks the information, A, is all online and can be digested in that fashion, and B, who doesn't understand, even if all the information were actually online, if you are someone who's not from this ecosystem, you don't know what to search, you don't have access to that information. So it's like, you know, little stuff like that. And I really just wanted to, I felt like I could not progress as an entrepreneur, as, you know, a human being independently within Silicon Valley anymore. And that's why I decided to move.
That sounds like a nice way to say, hey, these white folks out in Silicon Valley, you know, there's a lot of fakery, and I'm just not feeling what you guys are doing out here.
Yeah. Yes. Get out of my head, Jamarlin. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's really what it was. You know, new me was in transition. We were really, see, what a lot of people don't understand is a lot of these accelerators and incubators, they're started by people who are independently wealthy. So they've had another company and have funded it themselves. New me has never been that. We basically were able to raise money to get sponsors to support us so that we could operate this thing. But then that became tricky when the sponsors wanted certain things that were not in the best interest, I personally think, of the entrepreneurs that we were working with. So I had to change our business model. And then when we were changing our business models, you know, certain people weren't feeling it at all. And so I had to do a lot of bullshit, basically, to keep things stable professionally before I moved. So for instance, the 1 week accelerator that, you know, we've been doing for years now, and now it's other people, you know, that are doing it. It's other people that are doing online accelerators. And I've been doing that. I tested that in 2014, but I had to test it privately because it was frowned upon by people who were supporting me. And so I just didn't want to operate in a covert way because I was scared that XYZ person was going to say something bad about the direction that we were going and then give this signal. Silicon Valley is all about signaling. Give this signal to the ecosystem when the reality of it was actually quite opposite, because we were doing great work. We were able to help more people. We still had the same outcomes. Like, people have raised over $43 million now at this point.
If you like what you're hearing, you could check us out at moguldom.com. That's moguldom.com. That's moguldom.com. We have the latest information on tech, crypto, the business of Hollywood, and economic empowerment. You can also check me out on Twitter at Jamarlin Martin. Let's get back to the podcast. When you're in the belly of the beast, you're living in SV. Do you feel like in some areas you were blacklisted? In terms of, hey, I keep it real. I'm not coming out here in San Francisco tap dancing. I don't care. I have a mission. I'm here for the people. I'm here for my movement. And I don't give a fuck.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like they like kind of tap dancing, kind of safe Negroes, and you weren't playing along?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the people who I felt did this the most shall remain nameless, but you know, people always show you who they are if you watch and if your eyes are open. And if you watch how certain people move within the ecosystem, they only get the black folks that's around them that can be manipulated. And I started...
They're weak.
They're right? weak. So, they can be manipulated. Yeah. They will do whatever they need to do. And then when I saw that started to happen, I stopped getting invited to certain events.
Like, man, y'all trying to run a modern plantation out here.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of your sponsors, you know, their market caps are hundreds of billions of dollars. Can you just kind of give us an example of, hey, you know, I want to do this, what's in the best interest of the people and the mission, but why are you guys asking for this PR stuff? This is not about PR.
Yeah. So, all right. So when we first started selling sponsorships for New Me, it was a social impact kind of thing. Like, people really felt good supporting us because they were doing the right thing. And then we had the exposure of, you know, the CNN documentary special. And then we went back the next year for more funding. And because we had this exposure, you know, it was obviously increased. And then the next year, you know, we just kept getting bigger and bigger and better and better. And the next year we went to increase it, but it was capped, I think, at a certain amount that was unrealistic for the level of exposure that they were getting from the brand affiliation from New Me. New Me is the first black accelerator. Off top, just being associated with us says, whether you say it verbally or not, says that you're about black entrepreneurs and supporting them, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it just really, it became not the best thing for me or for New Me to continue certain partnerships where, you know, people really wanted us to stay the same.
Yeah.
They wanted us to be, you know, a 12-week accelerator and not do anything different, because Y Combinator does it this way, so why do it any other way? And it doesn't matter if this new way is actually a better way and we can reach more people and all of these other benefits. They weren't feeling it.
Do you think you leaving SB, in part due to the some beef with the culture out there, that's correlated with studies have shown a lot of black people have left companies like Google, Facebook, just because in the culture, it's really hard to keep your blackness intact. Hey, I'm not tucking that in. I'm not tap dancing. I want to work in an environment that's supportive for my mental health, who I am, my own self-awareness. But these environments are actually neutering the professional, and so they're leaving. So it's not a lot of people say, hey, it's not a lot about getting more black folks into Google and Facebook, because a lot of these people will leave for cultural considerations.
Right.
Do you think there's a comparison between the two?
What's interesting is I was just reading an article talking about all people leaving Silicon Valley. Like, they're leaving in droves. In fact, there's a U-Haul shortage because so many people are leaving. I'll try to tweet.
Mainly for cultural considerations.
Yeah, it's expensive to live there. Yeah. Like, people, there's better places to live that are more diverse. You know what I mean? For a lot of different reasons. I personally left because, you know, I was there for work. Like I said, I felt like, first off, this phrase, the belly of the beast, that's very much what it felt like, because there weren't a lot of black people out there. There were like, you know, there were some, but it was, you know, I did not feel like there weren't the Blavities and the Afrotechs of the world, and shout out to them and what they're doing, where there's other black people that look like you, you know what I mean, and talk like you, and you could actually be yourself. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of with New Me, because when we were bringing people out there for 12 weeks, like, that's what we created in this little bubble that we had. And that's why everybody that comes through New Me is like a family. It's not like an accelerator.
Speaking of New Me, you've touched quite a few people in the black tech space. I believe you worked with Brian Dixon, who's now a venture capital partner at Kapoor.
Mm-hmm.
You worked with him initially.
So Brian, I mentored Brian when he was still in school. I was working out of the Kapoor's office, and this was the early days of New Me. And he was there like on an internship, and I let him kind of shadow some things that I was doing. Yeah, with New Me.
Brian Brekeen. You're an investor in his company. Yeah. You backed him early on.
Yep, 2012. Yeah. When like he was super, super early.
And the founders that have gone through New Me, how much capital have they raised?
So far, they've raised about $43
million. Wow.
Actually, a little over $43
million. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a Black accelerator that has that?
No. Can we cuss on this?
Yeah. Sure.
Talk
shit.
No.
Yeah. So, you know, the founders that you're mentoring, that you're teaching with New Me, what are the things that they struggle with the most outside of, hey, it's hard to raise capital, but just in terms of getting into the tech game, it's not like it's native to the culture in terms of we know a lot of people in the culture that come up through this system. What are they struggling with the most in terms of the Black founders that you work with?
Honestly, what a lot of people don't understand is a lot of my job is showing people how to maneuver in this space. Like, you know, yes, we do, you know, other stuff like, you know, work on your product, make sure, you know, you actually have traction, you know, work on your pitch deck. But all of those things are tactics so that you are equipped to maneuver the right way in the space to get to your goal. That's all I do. And so, you know, the relationships that I have with investors are important for that. And then the relationships that I have with entrepreneurs are important for that.
But what about kind of, you know, mapping out their business plan, their forecasting, you know, how are they thinking about recruiting a talented team? Mm-hmm. Like, are there any areas you see like, hey, you know, a lot of these founders are struggling with this thing?
I would definitely say most entrepreneurs, not just Black entrepreneurs, get caught up in the idea of a product. And not even if they execute the idea, it's like they get so caught up in the idea of it that they forget, oh shit, I gotta make money. You know what I mean? And they don't realize like, oh, you need a business model. Oh, you need a financial model. How does your business model scale? One founder that I had worked with was really, really good at this. And this is not a blanket statement, so this doesn't, you know, apply to everyone, but, you know, Frederick Hudson at Pigeonly, who I'm also an investor in that company, was what he did extremely well off top when I started working with them in 2013 is he knew his business inside and out from a numbers perspective. He was probably we started in 2011, he was probably the first entrepreneur that I had met at that point that really understood their business from that perspective. So the conversations that he had with investors were completely different. So we're talking about early stage capital, right? Where most of it is focused on the idea.
And if I remember correctly, the founder that you're talking about, he did time in jail.
Yeah, he was in jail or in prison for 5 years for trafficking marijuana across like several states.
And how did investors how did he navigate that in terms of the raising capital process?
At the time, that was actually a big discussion that we...
Like, man, I used to push weight. I'm changed now.
Well, it was a funny conversation because we did not know, you know, should he hide this part of him or should we position it that he was just like more of an expert? For him, he was working, his company is focused on inmate services. And so, you know, my gut at the time was saying, okay, well, you're a subject matter expert. This is no different than, you know, Joe, who is a machine learning, you know, engineer that's, you know, starting whatever startup. So we're going to position you as a subject matter expert. And that's what we did, you know, and it worked.
You talked about being a single mother with three kids. Can you talk to the audience, particularly the single mothers out there, who may doubt that they can do big things as you're doing big things professionally and kind of balance everything. Like what's part of your magic to be so ambitious to execute your business plan, but also, you know, be a good mother and raise three kids?
Well, first off, I threw the idea of balance out, I would say, a long time ago. You know, when I started as an entrepreneur, I was 26. And like I was divorced and single mom of three. So the idea, there was never really an idea of balance. It's every day is going to be different. I think people define balance as I have a routine. This is what I'm going to do every day. I have XYZ amount of time for myself. And that's cool and everything, but balance doesn't necessarily look like that all the time. You know, I worked really hard when, you know, I was in my 20s, and thank God I had, you know, the energy to do so. But when I was diagnosed with cancer, my kids went to live with my ex-husband full time. And then, you know, I was basically just taking care of myself. And so all of the balance that I didn't have in my life earlier on in my life, now it's like I have balance later in my life. So, you know, throwing out this idea of what balance actually is, I think is definitely step one. Also, finding your purpose. And your purpose, I think your purpose might change, and your purpose isn't you can't always easily articulate what it is. And sometimes it's just a feeling. And I have a feeling about myself that I am here on this planet for a reason. And it's not just to mother children. Like, that's a part of it. But I feel like I really do feel like I have a bigger purpose. And so that's kind of what drives me. And when I was younger, it drove me in a very, I think, masculine and ambitious way. And now I think that drives me in a more creative way, where I allow myself to explore different things creatively that will take me to my next level.
So essentially, you buy into, for yourself, the idea that, hey, you know, there's different ways to look at balance, where, hey, I'm going to go real hard for 10 years and I can kind of lighten the load and free up. My freedom will kind of come into play later once I accomplish these things. So for that 10 years, I'm just going to focus mainly on building my business.
I'm kind of saying that, but I'm kind of not saying that, because I feel like when people say, well, I'm just going to go hard for 10 years on this business, they really do go hard and they forget about their health. And that's not do that. But yeah, so go hard, I guess, with some perspective, you know, but then also just realize, especially if you're an entrepreneur, especially if you're about to be an entrepreneur, like you feel like that's just what you're going to do is create new things. It's going to be ups and downs. Like some years you might have 5 years straight where shit is really popping. And then you might have 2 years where stuff is slow, and that might be your year of balance. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that was my template. I used to say that a lot, that, you know, I would go super hard for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so a more balanced life would open up later. But for the audience, I want to share one of my favorite quotes from Jim Rogers, who's the co-founder of one of the most successful hedge funds with George Soros. This is what he says about success. Most of us don't have the discipline to stay focused on a single goal for 5, 10, or 20 years, giving up everything to bring it off. But that's what's necessary to become an Olympic champion, a world-class surgeon, or a Kirov ballerina. Even then, of course, it may all be in vain. You may make a single mistake that wipes out all the work. It may ruin the sweet, lovable self you were at 17. That old adage is true. You could do anything in life, you just can't do everything. That's what Bacon meant when he said a wife and children were hostages to fortune. If you put them first, you probably won't run the 3.5-minute mile, make your first 10 million, write the great American novel, or go around the world on a motorcycle. Such goals take complete dedication. Do you believe a good deal of entrepreneurs, they come into the game thinking they can go out to parties, they can have a be in a committed relationship, they can spend time with their family, and you can compete with the best in the world and go, you know, scale a startup. How often do you see that kind of misperception?
You know what's interesting? I'm thinking about a lot of the founders that I worked with early on and knew me definitely subscribe to that, which is I'm foregoing a relationship. I'm foregoing these things of comfort because, you know, whatever they may be, because I'm focused on this business and, you know, what I want to get to, which, you know, was fine. I definitely think I encouraged that at the time. That's not something I just am in a different phase of life that I would encourage now. However, I do believe this quote, because most people expect for this idea of success to happen overnight, and it doesn't. Like, it literally takes 10 plus years to happen. And there's something admirable about somebody who can focus on something for that long consistently. There was a quote, I was actually just about to post it on my Instagram, and it said the secret to success is staying consistent when everyone else doesn't. And I totally believe that.
You talked about health. You're a cancer survivor. Can you talk about that experience and how that has kind of optimized how you view being a mogul and being a leader in the community and kind of what your next step is?
Sure. You said that so eloquently, because that's exactly what it is optimization. It's like, I still want to accomplish many of the same things, but now I'm smart enough to realize I'm not going to kill myself in the process. And I'm also, now I realize, like, oh shit, like, we're all really going to die. Because, like, when you're young in your 20s, I mean, you know you're going to die, but it's like, you don't really think about it. Like, yeah. You secretly think you're going to live forever, right?
Yeah.
But going through something like cancer, you're like, shh, my time really is limited. So how am I going to spend the time that I have left here? And once you start thinking about it from that perspective, it is a perspective of lack, but it forces you to get rid of all the bullshit. All the stuff that you don't really want to do, you're like, I'm not feeling this anymore. Then stop doing it and focus on something that, you know, you do like, that you are passionate about. And so, you know, in terms of my personal life, I use that. And, you know, cancer could have been seen, you know, by anyone as a negative situation, but it was really a positive situation for me, because I just feel like I have a better overall life from that experience. I just learned so much about myself as a business person, as like a human being. And I feel like I'm more prepared holistically to go to my next level now than I would have ever been before.
So Facebook recently has been in the news. The stock, I think, is down another 2% today.
Oh, wow.
It has lost over $100 billion in market cap.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks are angry and frustrated, disappointed in Facebook in terms of how they have handled the user data, their involvement with Cambridge Analytica. Do you believe Facebook has topped out, that it goes down from here, that it would be hard for that business to grow? If you had to make a bet, whether to bet on the price of Facebook going up, or you can use that money to bet that it's going to go down from here, would you be long or short?
I really just depend. I feel like that all depends on the news cycle and what's being fed.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? But what I will say is this, especially with internet companies, I mean, I guess with all companies, you have your seasons. Like, MySpace was popping and then it wasn't. You know, if I would invest, I think, in Facebook. I don't think it's topped out, only because, you know, Snapchat also had some other, you know, interesting falls in their stock. But I actually would have more faith in investing in a Facebook than a Snapchat, even though Snapchat is a newer platform. So, yeah.
Do you have any critique for the leadership at Facebook, going from Zuckerberg, Sandberg, Peter Thiel, Mark Andreessen? Do you feel any type of way in terms of how the company's being ran and who's like leading the company?
What I will say is I did watch the interview that Mark did with Lori Siegel on CNN. And, you know, the interview was good. It sounds like he's self-aware. It sounds like he realizes how transparent he should have been way before. And, you know, he's not someone that is like a fan of being public and doing interviews, but I think that's something that you have to do when you're the CEO of like a huge company. And so, you know, whether you're a socially awkward person, like he should have been giving, you know, being that transparent.
Yeah. And, Cambridge Analytica out of the UK, the British Parliament wanted, Mark Zuckerberg to come and talk to them and explain some things. He kicks it to a product person and another
now
person.
Now, that's crazy.
Today he announced that he would not speak to Parliament. So he'll go after everybody's data. He'll go collect that check. Mm-hmm. But when the government, who are elected by the people or represent the people, he won't talk to the people.
Right.
You know, it calls into question not only him, but I think Sheryl Sandberg as well is... What spooks them out so much in terms of...
Well, they need to have someone from executive leadership, like not a product person. So Sheryl or Mark needs to be, you know, the people for sure at that.
And so with Sheryl Sandberg, a lot of people, you know, have talked about, hey, you know, there's no people of color on the board. They just hired Kenneth Chenault from Amex like in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
But... they seem super, super light on this concept of diversity. Facebook is facing a lot of criticism, but I feel like Sheryl Sandberg, she's getting a pass, in part because she's a white woman. She's getting a pass in terms of being held accountable. So when she came to Facebook, she's like, hey, she's the adult in the room, right?
Right.
She's going to go watch Mark and kind of... Right. tidy up the place, and this little kid, this little geek is running the company. But now that the trouble is really kind of pervasive, the problems are really pervasive, I don't see a lot of criticism for her specifically, meaning that she can ride the stock up and get all the glory, but when it's time to face the heat, hey, I'm not sticking my neck out there. I'm not saying too much.
I mean, that's just not... I feel like if you've been in Silicon Valley, like, that's not surprising. If you are a darling... in Silicon Valley, like, people are just not going to come for you like that. And I definitely feel like she's one of those people. You know, if you can find this interview, there's an interview that her and I were on when she was promoting the Lean In campaign initially. We did it on Huffington Post. And I asked her a question about, you know, there, like, everybody's talking about how great this is, but you're not talking about a large percentage of women, which is black women, who are single moms.
Didn't somebody call her out on social media after a recent election where black women really carried the Democratic candidate over? I think someone called her out on social media.
I don't know. I might have missed that, especially if it was on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter as much anymore. But, you know, I asked her directly in the interview and she curved the question like a champ. You know what I mean? Like, this is what she does. And, you know, then after, you know, she started, I think she started being more aware and including people like Oprah, right? So now you have a black woman involved. And so, you know, I think she did strategic things like that. But if just take a look back, do some research very early on, like the Lean In campaign very early on, it was about white women.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said that, because when she comes on Bloomberg and she's like, you know, we're going to do more to help minorities, we're not doing enough. When I hear a Sheryl Sandberg say, well, she says women and minorities. When I hear her say women and minorities, I feel like black people are not really at the table. That African-American who comes from a descendant of slaves here in the United States, that really, like, you know, we're in the back of the bus when these Silicon Valley people are talking about women and minorities.
Okay, so for people who don't know, I'm going to definitely drop some gems on you right now. This is how it works in Silicon Valley. So after the CNN documentary, Black in America, everybody was about diversifying Silicon Valley in favor of black people, right? That's what people wanted. then the narrative started to shift. And if you look back at other things in history, this happens historically. The narrative started to shift from Black people to women. And now a lot of the resources are going to women. When they talk about diversifying, they're talking about women. And it still remains Google, whomever can, Facebook, they can all publish this, you know, diversity data all they want every year. But until they make some real changes, the numbers are going to stay flat. And they have been flat. That's because they don't actually really care, in my opinion.
If we were to look back 10 years from now and we look at the data, so there's all this talk about diversity, inclusion. When you look at the actual numbers of who, what groups are actually going to benefit the most, dollar for dollar,
right?
What percentage of that pie is going to be white women, in terms of out of 100% of people are the progress we see from here?
Right. I mean, white women are still privileged. So, you know, if you think about it, out of this whole pie that we have to diversify the industry, resources are being redirected to a group that's still privileged, but they are a minority, but they are still privileged in comparison to Black and brown, specifically African Americans, Black people, and Hispanic people.
How much of this is our fault, where we haven't checked the Sheryl Sandbergs, the Mark Zuckerbergs, the elites in Silicon Valley that talk about people of color, women, minorities? Why haven't the Black community said, hey, call out African American? I want to hear my name in that sentence, in terms of, if you're really serious about inequality, I don't want to be lumped in with everybody else. My story is so different than everybody else.
Because they're scared. Like, if you're scared, say you're scared. They're scared. This is why I stopped taking sponsorship dollars.
Yeah.
When you take money from people, they control the narrative. If I take money from said company, how vocal can I really be without fucking up my pockets?
Is a lot of the problem on our side, at least folks who are challenging the folks out in Silicon Valley, the elites in Silicon Valley, is that it seems like everyone's banging with like a Dr. King flag, but we don't have enough people who, you know, are really, you know, telling the people the truth. Because obviously everybody wants them. Everyone wants a check. Everyone wants, you know, to get a promotion or an investment in a company, or they want to get the white folks in Silicon Valley to back them, to sponsor them, to give them a halo over their head.
Right.
So I feel like that has completely compromised a lot of smart people out there, where no one's really speaking the truth because they're scared.
Yeah, they're scared, and or they are motivated by money. So, and nothing's wrong with money. Don't get me wrong. I like money too, but I know who I am, you know, in my core, and I'll make decisions based on what I think is right, period. Not because of the money that's, I've walked away. I've had to restart my business and walk away from hundreds of thousands of dollars just because I knew something wasn't right.
Yeah.
You know?
And what do you say to that entrepreneur who says, look, I cannot, you know, speak the truth or speak up for the people, my particular group. I just need to get this money. I'm going to shut up and dribble for 10 years. Michael Jordan did that for the most part. You know, I'm just going to shut up and dribble, and I'll worry about the social stuff and fight for my people after I get this money. So I'm just going to shut up and dribble for the next 10 years.
I think everybody has their place in a fight like this. And I think the best thing that we can do is be strategic and leverage where everyone's at. So the people who are in that place and are like, I'm gonna shut up and dribble, but I'm gonna reinvest in my community in 10 years. That's fine. That's cool. You're in this box right here. But the problem is 90% of the people, Black people in Silicon Valley, can't be in that box. We gotta have some people that are willing to call people out, that are willing to, you know, take, well, not even, I was going to say take sacrifices, but not, I'm not even going to say that. It's just really challenge people. This is about challenging people. And we're not speaking up so that people are being challenged. And this was myself included. Like, you know, when my business model was different with New Me and I was living in Silicon Valley and I was in the belly of the beast, it was extremely stressful. I didn't feel like I had a good, you know, even personal support network where of just friends where I could talk to like real, and they didn't want nothing from me, or it wasn't going to circle, you know, go back, you know, be back channeled to somebody else in Silicon Valley. I didn't have an outlet of people that I really trusted. And so, you know, I wasn't even in a position to call people out. And I, you know, I still think about it. There have been times where I feel like I should have called people out. And I didn't.
Thanks everyone for supporting the Go Podcast. You can check me out on Twitter at Jamarlin Martin. You can also check us out at moguldom.com. Be sure to subscribe to our Moguldom newsletter. You're going to get the latest on crypto, tech, economic empowerment, and politics. If you like the show, be sure to go to moguldom.com. Let's go.